us, and we're very happy he was able to join us for a convention in 1995. The subject he has for this afternoon is God's Master Contract. God's Master Contract.
Thank you, Brother Dan, and good afternoon, brethren. It's our privilege and pleasure to be with you, and Sister Tony and I rejoice in the fellowship and the edification that we have received here. We do bring you the love and greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia, with whom we are privileged to meet. You know, our God is a God of contracts. He's a God of agreements. God is continually dealing with his creatures within the terms of a contract. The scriptures have a name for these contracts. The scriptures call them the covenants. And for purposes of today's lesson, we will use the word contract and covenant interchangeably. The prophet Hosea tells us that after God created Adam, he entered into a contract with him. What were the terms of this contract? Very simple. Obedience would yield life, and disobedience would yield death. Our pastor suggests that the angels enjoyed a contractual or covenant relationship with God. God entered into a contract with the angels. What was the terms of this contract? Obedience assured the angels life and liberty. And disobedience assured them incarceration and eventually destruction to those who would be unrepentant. Perhaps the most well-known covenant amongst those in the world is the covenant that God made with Noah. God promised Noah that never again would there be a global flood that would destroy everything. And the scriptures tell us that every time that you and I look up after a rain and we see a rainbow, the rainbow is our assurance, our personal, that's God's signature, friends, on that contract. Never again will there be global destruction by way of a flood. But friends, these contracts, these covenants that we have just referenced stand in contrast. They stand in sharp contrast to the great covenants of the Bible. The church's covenant of sacrifice, the old law covenant, the new law covenant, and what we believe to be the greatest covenant of all, the covenant with Abraham. Now, in a previous lesson on this subject, we looked into how these great covenants relate to one another. And based upon Paul's discourse in Galatians, the third chapter, we believe that we may properly view these four covenants as contracts. We may view God's covenant with Abraham as the master contract, and the Sarah and the Hagar and the Keturah covenants were subcontracts, or are subcontracts, to the master contract with Abraham. You know, in a construction project, we have essentially two different kinds of contracts. We have the master contract or the general contract, and you have subcontracts. That's the way most large construction projects are put together. And each subcontract advances a portion of the exact purpose and the exact goal of the general contract for that project. And so likewise, we think that we may properly illustrate or view the Hagar and the Sarah and the Keturah covenants. Each one of those advances another portion of the exact purpose and the exact goal that God set forth in his contract with Abraham. That's a very brief overview of a prior lesson on this particular subject as to how these covenants, we might view them as being related to one another. But our focus today is going to be on the master contract. Our focus today is going to be exclusively on the Abrahamic covenant. In our lesson today, we want to view just two questions. First is when and where and under what circumstances was the Abrahamic covenant brought into existence? How was it established, and when and where? And the second question is a question you would ask of any contract. What's the terms? If you were to pick up this contract and read it, what does it read? What does it say to us? Let's take a look at our first question. When and where and how and under what circumstances was God's covenant with Abraham made? We believe that the scriptures tell us that God's contract with Abraham was established in three main steps. We're going to turn, and if you would join me, please, in looking at Genesis, the 11th chapter, and also a portion of the 12th chapter, a portion of the 11th and 12th. We're going to read Genesis chapter 11, verses 31 through the end of the chapter, and then chapter 12, verses 1 through 5. But there's one thing that we want to notice as we read these verses, and that is, we don't believe that as they are written, they are in the correct chronological sequence. So we're going to read them in the sequence in which we believe that they occurred. We start with Genesis, the 12th chapter, verse 1. We'll read 1 through 3. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now we go back to chapter 11, verses 31 and 32. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarah, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came into Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. We now jump back down to chapter 12, and we read verses 4 and 5. So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. Before we go on, you'll notice here that these particular texts refer to Abraham as Abram. We know why, you get a little further along in Genesis, and we read of the reason that God changed Abram's name from Abram to Abraham. But for purposes of simplicity during our lesson today, particularly because this subject involves him both before and after his name change, we're always just going to refer to him as Abraham. Saint Stephen confirms for us that Abraham was in Ur of the Chaldees when God first spoke to him. And we read of this in Acts chapter 7, verses 2 to 4. Acts 7, 2 to 4. And he said, Men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abram when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Charan, and said unto him, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and come into a land which I will show thee. Then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans, and dwelt in Charan. And from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land wherein ye now dwell. On the board, we have drawn two lines and three points, point one, two, and three. Point one is Ur of the Chaldees. It was here in Ur, in Mesopotamia, today it's Iraq, I believe, is where God first approached Abraham. And he made a proposal. He made a promise to Abraham that we just read of in Genesis. And God responded to that proposal, to that promise. How did Abraham respond? Abraham and his wife, his nephew Lot, his father, the entire family, entire immediate family. There were other clan, other of his clan that were left behind. But that entire family, that immediate family, left Ur of the Chaldees and headed up to Ur. Or they headed up to up the Euphrates Valley, up to Haran, which is point two on our diagram. In the New Testament, Stephen calls it Charon, which is the same thing. Today we understand that Haran is in the southern part of Turkey, just about on the border with Syria. It was here, at point two, or in Haran, that Terah took sick, and he died. And at age 75, Abraham and his wife and Lot and the others that were with them, the entire family, they continued the Lord's lead. The Lord had led them from Ur to Haran, and now they would continue the Lord's lead. They left Haran, and they journeyed in a southwesterly direction down into Canaan. From point one to point two is about 500 miles, 525 miles. From point two to point three is about another 450 miles. Now, with these facts in mind, let's return to the first question. Exactly where was this Abrahamic covenant made? Was it made when he was in Ur? Was it made when he was in Haran? Was it made when he arrived in Canaan? Exactly where was this covenant made? Well, we think that it might be helpful in order to understand where the covenant was made is to first perhaps understand something about contracts, just contracts in general. You know, under man's system of jurisprudence, at least the one that I'm familiar with, a contract only becomes a contract when three components are present simultaneously. First, there must be an offer. Second, there must be an acceptance of that offer. And thirdly, there must be legal consideration, or the equivalent of legal consideration. Legal consideration, by the way, is the legal glue that makes a deal binding between two parties. That's it. That's all it takes to make a contract: an offer, an acceptance, and legal consideration, or its equivalent. Now, from the standpoint of offers and acceptances, there are two kinds of contracts. Just two kinds. There are bilateral contracts, and there are unilateral contracts. We believe that it would be very helpful, just by way of illustration, to understand where the Abrahamic covenant actually was established, to understand the difference between a bilateral contract and a unilateral contract. We hope to illustrate this by way of two examples. And Brother Richard, I'm going to pick on you if you don't mind. It won't hurt, I promise. Let's say I have some tools. I know Brother Richard likes to work with his hands, if my memory serves me right. Let's say I go up to Brother Richard and I have these tools, and they're good tools, and Brother Richard would like to have them. So I go up to Brother Richard and I say, "Brother Richard, I've got these tools, and I'm not very good with my hands, so I'd like to sell these to you. And $50, that'll do it." Well, Brother Richard looks at these tools, and he says, "Let me see these." So he takes a look at these tools in his tool pouch, and right away, he's got a sharp eye for tools. He's, "Well, they're worth a lot more than 50. He says to himself, "These are worth a lot more than $50. So he says, "You got a deal." He says, "I'll promise to give you the $50. Do Brother Richard and I have a contract at that point? Brother Richard shakes his head yes, and he's right. We absolutely have a contract at that point. The question is, what kind of a contract is it? The answer is, it's a bilateral contract. Why? Because the contract was made through a mutual exchange of promises. A mutual exchange of promises is how a bilateral contract is put together. I promise to do something. I promise to sell Brother Richard a pouch full of tools for $50. Brother Richard gave me a mutually reciprocal promise. He promised to give me $50. We both made promises to one another. In a bilateral contract, it's the mutual exchange of promises that creates the bargain. It creates the contract. The mutual exchange of promises, by the way, is also the legal consideration. That act is also the legal glue. That's the glue that holds the deal together. But now let's consider an entirely different example. I suspect most everyone here has seen an old Western movie from time to time. What came to my mind in this was Gunsmoke. It used to be on Monday nights when I was a kid. And remember those infamous wanted posters that used to hang outside of the U.S. Marshal's office? The posters would read something like this: wanted, dead or alive, $500. And then you had this really scruffy looking picture of this guy on the poster that they were looking for. Well, the deal is quite simple in this case. Any person who would bring this outlaw in and deliver him to the marshal, whether he was breathing or not, was entitled to the sum of $500. Now, let's analyze this arrangement a little bit closer. Let's identify, if we can, the offer and the acceptance and the legal consideration in this idea of the reward to bring in this criminal. Identifying the offer is easy. The wanted poster constitutes the offer. The marshal's offer is something like this, if we could paraphrase it. The marshal is saying, I promise to give to the person who brings this outlaw in the sum of $500. That's it. That's the offer. Bring him in, you get $500. How about the acceptance? The acceptance of this offer is in the performance of what the offer is asking someone, anyone, to do. The person who actually brings in and delivers the outlaw to the U.S. Marshal's doorstep is the one who accepts the offer. There's no contract with anybody until the outlaw is delivered to the marshal's doorstep. Now, what happens if Mr. Bounty Hunter sees this poster outside of the marshal's office? And he goes running into the marshal's office. He said, Marshal, I just saw your poster outside that you just put up. I promise you, Marshal, in fact, I guarantee you, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find this outlaw and I'm going to bring him back and I'm going to deliver him to you. Is there a contract at that point between Mr. Bounty Hunter and the U.S. Marshal? Answer, absolutely not. There is no contract. Why? Because this is not a bilateral contract. It's a unilateral contract. Now, what's una? We all know what una means. Una means one. But what's one? What is the oneness about this arrangement? The marshal is the only one making any promises. The poster did not solicit a reciprocal promise from anybody. Didn't ask for a return promise, unlike in our tool example. The offer asks for performance, not a promise of performance. The only way that Mr. Bounty Hunter can establish a contractual right to get this $500 is to go out, find the outlaw, and bring him in. Now, perhaps we can talk about maybe just for a moment, just a more current example of a unilateral contract. I suspect if I ask anyone here at the beginning of this, how many of you have had experience with a unilateral contract, I suspect I have seen very little hands, very few hands. Has anyone here sold their home through a real estate agent? Anyone ever dealt with a realtor? Okay, I see several hands. At least in our jurisdiction, typically real estate contracts are basically real estate listing contracts are basically unilateral contracts. Why? Because a reciprocal promise, when you put your home up for sale, a reciprocal promise or 1,000 reciprocal promises by a real estate agent or a real estate broker to you to sell your house, those are meaningless. Because you, the homeowner, are not required to pay a commission to a real estate broker until that broker produces a ready, willing, and able buyer who is prepared to buy your property. Until the broker actually performs by bringing in and delivering a ready, willing, and able buyer, there's no contract. The listing contract that you signed basically is a unilateral contract. Once the buyer is produced, at that moment, the contract is formed. And the homeowner, you the homeowner, are contractually obligated to pay the commission. Hopefully it maybe gives you a little bit more of a modern example we can have a touchstone with. We suggest, friends, that the Abrahamic covenant is a unilateral contract. And we may look at it as such. What we read in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, where God appeared to Abraham in Ur of the Chaldees, that did not establish the covenant. That was a promise, it was a proposal, it was an offer. We're using those words interchangeably. Genesis 12, 1 to 3 constitutes God's promise or his offer. It was while Abram was down there that God made him this offer. In simplified terms, God's offer was this. And we're paraphrasing. Abraham, if you leave Ur, if you leave there and you go to some place that I will show you, if you do that, if you leave most of your clan behind and you follow my lead to a new country, I promise I'm going to do A, B, and C, and the things that we talked about in the scriptures. Now let's assume that Abraham, when he was at point one on the board, after God had made this proposal to him, let's assume that Abraham would have gone back to God and said, Yahweh, I promise you, I'll move to wherever you show me. Would the Abrahamic covenant have been established by that responsive promise on behalf of Abraham to God? We believe that that would not establish the covenant at that point. Why? Because the Abrahamic covenant is not a bilateral contract. God did not ask. We find no place in the scriptures where God asked Abraham for a reciprocal promise. God asked Abraham to pick up with his immediate family and to move to a place that would eventually turn out to be Canaan. As we said, we see in the scriptures where the Abrahamic covenant was essentially established in three stages, three phases. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, would be at point 1 on our diagram. That's the first stage in the establishing of the Abrahamic covenant. That's the offer stage, God's offer to Abraham. Or if you prefer to refer to it as God's promise to Abraham or God's proposal, any of those terms would be fine. Genesis chapter 11, the last two verses, verses 31 and 32, and Genesis 12, verses 4 and 5, record the second stage of the making of this Abrahamic covenant. That's point 2 on our diagram on the board. That's the acceptance stage. Abraham's entire journey, beginning at point 1 and going to point 2, and ending up in point 3, that entire 1,000-mile journey constitutes Abraham's acceptance of God's offer. God's covenant with Abraham became established. It took effect at the moment that he set foot in Canaan. Once he arrived at point 3 on our board here, it was automatic. No further promises, no further assurances were necessary to fully establish this covenant. We would suggest, friends, that before Abraham set foot in Canaan, we have the Abrahamic promise. Once Abraham set foot in Canaan, we have the Abrahamic covenant. We no longer have a promise. If you wish to continue to refer to it as the Abrahamic promise, that's fine. But the reason that we feel that that's where the covenant was established is because we're putting this contract between God and Abraham in the strongest possible terms that we have ability to do so in our feebleness in our English language. Once Abraham arrived at point three, the covenant was established. And to this day, friends, we have the Abrahamic covenant. Now, even though we're suggesting that the establishing of this covenant was complete and it was entire when Abraham set foot in Canaan, we believe that there is still a third major phase to the establishment of the Abrahamic covenant. Back here at point one, we believe what we understand as best we're able to discern from the scriptures that Abraham was about 75 years old at the time that God made his covenant with him. Excuse me, not point one, point three. When he arrived in Canaan, he was approximately 75 years of age at that time. We know that there was a number of years then that passed, and much time came and went. Numerous times and in various terms, as we read through the different books, or the different chapters, rather, of Genesis, God reiterated the terms of this covenant. He clarified them. He repeated this covenant to Abraham, sometimes using different terminology. But basically, it was always the same covenant, always the same contract. Numerous times in the years after he arrived in Canaan, God went to Abraham and he shored up his faith in this covenant by means of verbal assurances. There were outward signs, and sometimes there were special ceremonies, such as the one that he suggested with regard to circumcision. And through these means, God kept assuring Abraham, after he arrived in Canaan, he kept reassuring him that he would fulfill this covenant. When Abraham, being in Canaan, became approximately 86 years of age, Ishmael was born. And 14 years later, when Abraham was 100 years of age, Isaac was born. So we can see a number of years are passing. Already we have 25 years passed since he first set foot in Canaan. And it was approximately yet 125 years after that when Isaac was approximately 25 years of age that God went to Abraham and gave him another and certainly a supreme test of faith. His faith had already been tested, simply just in the journey, if nothing more. But his faith would be tested yet one more time. And we know what that test is. It's where God asked Abraham to give up Isaac, his beloved son, in sacrifice. And as we know, he eventually did that, not literally, but he did so by faith in a figure. Abraham not only endured. Friends, he was asked to give up his only begotten son. That had to be a grueling experience. He not only endured this grueling test, but he passed this test of faith. Abraham was fully faithful in this test. And God responded. God responded to this manifestation of faith on Abraham's part. And we believe that God's response to this test and Abraham's faithfulness in this experience constitutes the third major phase of the full establishing of the Abrahamic covenant. Consider with me Genesis, the 22nd chapter, verses 15 to 18. Genesis 22, 15 to 18. This is immediately after he was asked to sacrifice his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. It was a full half century after Abraham set foot in Canaan the first time that God sealed his covenant, his contract with Abraham. And he did so, as we see here, as we read, through the means of an oath. We believe that God's oath is that third major phase of the establishment of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, what did God's oath do? What was the reason that God gave an oath to Abraham? God's oath did not add any new terms to the Abrahamic covenant that he had made some 50 years earlier. But if you say, well, look, if the oath did not add any new terms to the Abrahamic covenant, then why did God go to the trouble of making this oath? Why did he go to the trouble of sealing the Abrahamic covenant with his oath? Consider with me a few verses in Hebrews chapter 6. We believe that the answer is given to us by the Apostle Paul as to why God gave Abraham this oath. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 13 through 19. For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he sware by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife, wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope which is set before us, which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil. God did not give this oath to Abraham because there was any deficiencies in the original Abrahamic contract. God gave this oath. Certainly there was some benefit, no doubt, to directly, personally, to Abraham, but Paul is telling us here that God gave this oath for your benefit and my benefit. That's why the oath was put into place. That's why God gave it. The oath was to offset any doubt that we might feel because, first of all, of the long delay in the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. It's been a long time, hasn't it, since the Abrahamic covenant was made. 4,000 years? We haven't seen the fulfillment of that contract yet. Maybe we might have start the tendency to doubt. We don't normally see contracts go 4,000 years without being fulfilled. So perhaps the long delay was one of the reasons that God felt it helpful to us to give this oath. But there's another reason that we think that God gave this oath to Abraham. And that is, you know, God's promise or covenant with Abraham is really a promise to give a gift. You know, in human terms, a promise to give a gift is not binding. That's how man looks at the promise to give somebody a gift. It's not binding. Man generally views a promise to give a gift as something that is unreliable. It's weak. It's unenforceable. It's not binding. The promisor, one who makes a promise to give a gift, can make it one moment and retract it the next. You see, that's from man's point of view. So therefore, the recipient of that promise generally views that as something that's unreliable. A person might change their mind. Take it back. Why? Because a promise to give a gift does not have legal consideration. There can be an offer, and there can be even be an acceptance. But there's no legal consideration. There's no legal glue And that's why a promise to give a gift is generally viewed as being weak. God's oath was like a seal on this Abrahamic covenant. And we think we might properly refer to it as that. Remember, we said you have to have an offer and an acceptance and legal consideration, or the equivalent of legal consideration, in order to have a binding commitment. A seal on a contract obviates the need for legal consideration. A sealed contract is binding even though there is no legal consideration, because the seal is the equivalent of legal consideration. Now, you could say, well, technically Abraham did give some consideration for this promise, this offer that he did accept. He did give some legal consideration for this covenant. After all, he journeyed from point one all the way down to point three, some 1,000 miles, and we suspect that most of it was on foot. But friends, even though maybe in a technical sense that would be considered some consideration, we believe that this consideration at best would be nominal compared to what God was promising. God's proposal to Abraham basically constituted a promise to give a gift. And God's oath, we believe, the second reason that he gave this oath was that we believe that this oath compensated for any perceived lack of bindingness for this covenant. God gave this oath to clearly show us that his covenant was not weak. He gave us this seal to show us that his promise was not unbinding. He gave us that to prove, indeed, the complete reliability. He anticipated your skepticism and my skepticism about the fulfillment of this commitment. He anticipated it and he neutralized it through the use of this seal, this oath. So we believe that this oath proves to us that the covenant is a virtual certainty. Paul talks about the two immutable things in the verses that we just read. Both the promise as well as the oath are both immutable. As we understand, immutable means unchangeable. Neither one of them can be changed. That's the three major phases, we believe, that go together to comprise the full establishment of the Abrahamic covenant. God's offer made at point one, Abraham's journey from point one to point three being the acceptance of that offer, and his arrival, most importantly, his arrival in Canaan, and thirdly, God's oath made to Abraham on Mount Moriah. Let's consider the second question. We wanted to first explore exactly where and under what conditions the covenant was established. But now we want to go beyond that. We want to explore exactly what are the terms of this contract that we feel is so critical, so important. You say, well, that's easy. In thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. We're done. That's what we used to think too. We're happy to have been very, very blessed, by the way, to have been enlightened on this particular subject, that there's a little bit more to it than just that, which we would ordinarily respond. At least that's the way I would ordinarily respond if somebody asked me what were the terms of the covenant. The verses that we read in Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, those two verses outline the terms of the offer or the promise that God made to Abraham. But in this offer, we believe that God purposely used somewhat sketchy language. Why do we suggest that? Because there is at least 11 other chapters in Genesis and in Exodus where God came back and either reiterated or amplified or elucidated the terms of the promise that he had made to Abraham in Ur. We'd like to give you those 11 chapters where God either defines or he clarifies or elucidates the terms of the Abrahamic covenant. I'm just going to give you the chapters. Genesis chapters 13, 15, 17, 18, 22, 26, 28, 35, 46, and Exodus chapters 3 and 6. When we analyze the proposal of the original covenant made when Abraham was in Ur, as well as these clarifications that God gave in these 11 other chapters that we just listed, when we analyze all these, we come to one conclusion. The Abrahamic covenant has three main parts to it. Part one of the Abrahamic covenant applies to Abraham and his seed personally. This part identifies the benefits that Abraham and his seed will receive personally. Part two of this contract applies to Abraham's seed and to their appointed work. And thanks to the Apostle Paul, in this part two of the Abrahamic covenant, we know that this part of the contract is two-dimensional. It has a spiritual dimension, and it has an earthly dimension. And we'll come back to that in a moment. Part three of the Abrahamic covenant applies to all the families of the earth. All mankind are the beneficiaries of part three of the Abrahamic covenant. Let's consider just one portion. There are several personal benefits as we read through all the chapters in Genesis. There are several personal benefits that will accrue to Abraham and his seed. We just want to consider one of them for purposes of illustration. I want to consider this one from Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 and 15. Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 and 15. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which thou seest to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. The terms of this part of the Abrahamic covenant are very simple. God promised to give the land of Canaan, the promised land, to Abraham and his seed. This is, friends, this is a part of the Abrahamic covenant. We would give you several citations on that. Second volume, page 45. Reprint, 5178, column 1 at the top. Reprint, 5182, column 2. This is not only a part of the Abrahamic covenant, it's a very predominant part of that covenant respecting Abraham and his earthly seed. In the chapters of Genesis and Exodus that we listed just a few moments ago, God repeated this land promise at least 8 times that we were able to find in these total 12 chapters where the Abrahamic covenant is referenced. 8 times to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and to Moses. You know, St. Stephen in Acts, the 7th chapter, tells us that God never delivered so much as a foot of Canaan to Abraham. What does he mean by that? I mean, after all, Abraham was in Canaan. He got there when he was age 75. He lived until he was 175. He was there almost a century. I know he was in Egypt a little bit of that time, but for the most part, he was 100 years. And Stephen says he never got so much as a foot of the land. What does Stephen mean? We believe that Stephen here is talking about permanent possession of the land. Time and again, the land of Canaan fell to the rule of the Philistines. It fell to the Egyptians. It fell to the Babylonians. It fell to the Turks and others. But Abraham, friends, Abraham will be resurrected. And Stephen assures us, he tells us in Acts chapter 7, that Abraham and his posterity are yet going to receive this land. God made him a promise. It's guaranteed. It's sure. The promise of the land is just one of the personal benefits to Abraham that flows from the contract, the master contract that God has with Abraham. There's other benefits as well. And you can read about those, and particularly in those 12 chapters that we mentioned a moment ago. We don't talk too much about this particular part of the covenant. Why? Perhaps because it's earthly. It's mostly personal to Abraham and to his earthly seed. But nevertheless, we appreciated the references where it was brought to our attention that this is an important part of the covenant that God made with Abraham. Let's go on now to talk about part two of the contract with Abraham. This pertains to Abraham's seed. Time and again, we know that God reiterated to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, that he was going to provide them with a seed. And on at least five occasions that we were able to find, God specifically said that their seed, this promised seed, would either be like either sand or dust of the earth, or like stars of the heaven. Let's consider one of these places where God reiterated this about Abraham's seed. We have already read these two particular verses. We're looking at Genesis chapter 22, verses 17 and 18. We won't reread them since we read them just a moment ago. But that's the one event that we just want to focus on for a moment. If we look up the Hebrew word seed here in this promise, in this text, seed means posterity, at least according to Strong's. Undoubtedly, when God had reiterated this promise, this part of the contract, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob probably thought that God was merely promising them children. Yeah, that was a great blessing to have children. In fact, the dust and the sand would probably suggest to their minds that they would have many children, be multitudinous children. But who is God referring to here in this particular text? We believe that God gives us a clue, a very important clue, at the end of verse 17. If we look at the end of verse 17, we see that God says that his seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. Possessing a gate, what does that mean to possess a gate? We believe that possessing a gate indicates power and control. It's like the gatekeeper. We talk about a gatekeeper. He's the one who's in control of who comes in or who doesn't come in. He's the one who, figuratively speaking, is the one in charge of things. The controller of the gate, we suggest, is another way of talking about the rulers. Who's in charge? We understand that the stars here represent the spiritual rulers. Paul talks about these spiritual rulers in 1 Corinthians 15, and we're all familiar with the text where he says, star differeth from star in glory. So he seems to clearly identify the stars with those who would be changed to spirit beings. But Paul gets more specific than that in terms of who these stars are. He tells us that the glorified Jesus is the seed of Abraham in Galatians 3:16. So we would suggest that based upon Paul's thoughts in Galatians 3:16, that Jesus is the chief spiritual gatekeeper. Jesus is the one who will eventually destroy all the enemies of the kingdom. But Jesus is not alone in that work, is he? He's not alone in controlling the gate. Because Paul goes on to say that Abraham's seed will include Christ's body. Christ's body, the Isaac class, later on in the third chapter of Galatians and also in Galatians 4:28. This means, friends, that the spiritual phase of the kingdom that you and I pray for is the Christ, head and body. They will be the spiritual rulers of the kingdom. The Christ, head and body, will be the spiritual gatekeepers. And we would cite to you Romans chapter 11, verse 26. Romans 11, 26. We would understand that the sand of the seashore represents the earthly phase of this kingdom. And just who are the earthly gatekeepers? You know, Jesus himself told us. He said in Luke 13:28, that the kingdom would consist of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets. And we would also cite for your consideration the first volume, page 290. We believe that the ancient worthies are the special agents among men. The ancient worthies are the earthly gatekeepers, so to speak. They will be the perfect government that we also are praying for, the perfect government amongst men. They will be the liaison, the communication link between the spiritual gatekeepers and the world of mankind. So together we believe that the Christ and the ancient worthies comprise the main spiritual and earthly rulership of God's kingdom. They are the seed of Abraham that possess the gate of the enemies. They're the ones in charge. They both will be God's instruments in blessing the world. Let's consider, in a few remaining minutes, the third part of the Abrahamic covenant. God told Abraham that he would make him the father of many nations. As we mentioned a few minutes ago, that's why he changed his name from Abram to Abraham. He wanted it clear that he was going to be the father of many nations. And eventually all those who want to be blessed will have to be of the earthly seed of Abraham. And we're now here looking at the seed in a broader sense than what we just did a few moments ago. In order to receive eternal life and to be of Abraham's seed in this broader, maybe in this finality sense, this means that they're going to have to develop Abraham's obedience. They will have to develop Abraham's trust. They will have to develop Abraham's humility. Each family that develops Abraham's obedience and his trust and his loyalty and his faith and his everything that was about him that represents that in connection with the seed, every family that develops that is going to indeed get the benefits that are promised under the terms of this commitment. They're going to get and they're going to enjoy eternal life. But this is only going to be true if they make the effort and become a part of this seed of Abraham in this wider, this more comprehensive sense. In closing, friends, there's one more term. This is not a comprehensive presentation by any means on all of the different facets of the Abrahamic covenant. But there's one other term of this contract that we'd like to touch upon before we close. You know, in your world and in my world here upon the earth, the contracts that we're accustomed to dealing with have normally one thing in common. They have a term. They have a limited life. They begin at a certain time, and then they are fulfilled at a certain time. Whether we're speaking about an employment contract, or a real estate listing contract, or a professional service contract, whatever it might be, has a limited term. We have considered in some detail when the Abrahamic covenant begins. When does the Abrahamic covenant, the master contract, when does it end? God himself gives us the answer. If you'll turn with me just briefly to Genesis chapter 17. There are a number of verses that will give us this precious thought. Genesis chapter 17, verse 7. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. How does he describe it here? An everlasting covenant. This grandest of all contracts, friends, has no termination date. What does that mean? Oh, that lifts our hearts when we realize that God has made a perpetual commitment to carry out the terms of this contract forever. It never ceases. You know, we've heard of the gift that keeps on giving. We've heard that phrase in advertisements of different things. God's master contract, friends, is His gift to mankind that will keep on giving forever.
Thank you, Brother Wes, on God's master contract.
Our gracious and kind and most loving Father who art in heaven, we thank Thee, Father, for condescending unto us and revealing Thyself unto us, another portion of Thy mind and Thy will and Thy plan. We thank Thee so much, Father, for the enlightenment that Thou hast given us on the subject of Thy greatest covenant with Abraham. Indeed, will bless all the families of the earth, for which we have so long prayed for the full establishment, and to see the full establishment of the kingdom and the grand fruition of all that Thou hast promised. We pray, Father, for forgiveness for anything thought or said or done which was displeasing unto Thee. Bless us now during our fellowship hour. May we continue to reset our affections upon things above. We ask and pray through Christ. Amen.